Welcome to the Simple Development Systems Podcast, where you'll be learning all about small shop fundraising and how to build a donor-focused development department from the ground up. Here's your host, publisher of the Grow Report, Pamela Grow.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pamela Grow, and today I have the distinct privilege of introducing you to Angel Aloma. Angel is the executive director of Food for the Poor. Food for the Poor works to uplift the poor in countries such as Haiti, Jamaica, Nicaragua, Trinidad, and many more as they struggle with poverty, hunger, and a lack of opportunity. So welcome and thanks so much for being here today, Angel.
It is my pleasure. Thank you, Pam, for having me.
Oh, thank you. Could you tell us a little bit before we get started about Food for the Poor, exactly what you do?
Sure. We are in 17 countries. We are a 32-year-old organization. Our name has become a misnomer, not because we don't do food. We do certainly a lot of food, but we also are involved in water projects, in housing construction, in medical, in education, and in many self-sustainable projects, which are the direction in which we move more and more as we get people to stop having children that are dying of hunger. We then try to get the family to find a way in which they can sustain themselves.
Ah, oh, that's such a beautiful mission.
And it is.
You know, we talked a little bit on how presented at the Fundraising Success Engage conference that was just this month in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And I met him before he presented, and I was really struck by what you said about donor centricity and what really understanding this aspect of fundraising has meant to your work. So could you tell us, our listeners, a little bit more?
Sure. Well, we thought that we were very donor-centric here. Basically, at every meeting we had, we very proudly pronounced that donor is king. But honestly, we were not really internalizing what the meaning of donor centricity was. But I went to Holland to the IFC and I heard a very inspired American. I went all the way to Holland to be inspired by an American, yes. His name was Tom Ahern. And he truly made me internalize the meaning of donor centricity. And I was sitting there as he was reading letters and appeals from other organizations thinking, oh, no, we don't do that. Oh, no, we don't do that. And then I got back home and I started reading our stuff and I thought, oh, my God, we do that. We talk about the organization. We talk about what Food for the Poor does, but we don't talk about what the donor does. And so I went on a campaign that we were no longer going to do this. And it took, I would say, a good 3 years to get the we have an internal creative department. It took about 3 years to get the writers to switch from founder organizational type messaging to donor messaging, because we are fortunate as a large organization, we were able to do an emotional inquiry study in our donor base. And we found out that the main reason that our donors give us is not necessarily because they want to help the poor, although I'm sure that is very high in their priorities. But the main reason is because they wanted to feel like decent, caring human beings in a world that seemed to lack such people. So we realized then also that what we had to do is speak to the donor in those terms, not to make us feel good about ourselves, but to make them feel good about themselves. And gratitude is such an important aspect. I think basically that all fundraising, I've gotten into arguments, believe it or not, where people say, oh, you don't have to thank your donors, so waste of time. And actually, with Roger Craver, he didn't argue this. It was someone on his blog that was arguing it. So I actually went on and gave them results that we have had from tests we had done of thanking people, and they were amazed. So we became then truly donor-centric, and now, like 4 years later, I can say that our copy truly centers on the donor more than anything else. And it has been amazing because we used to get a lot of complaints about too much mail. And we mail a lot. We were mailing 24 pieces at the time. Now we are actually mailing 27 pieces. and we get about 70% less complaints than before. And almost everyone who calls in, about 90% who says, take me off your donor list, we can convince them to take reduced mail, because many donors don't know it's within their possibilities to just call us and say, look, I'm getting these pieces. I'd like to get 12. I'd like to get 16. I'd like to get 6. I'd like to get 2. It's totally up to the donor, and that's part of the donor-centric issue. I realized, and stop me if I'm going on too long.
No, not at all. This is fascinating.
I realized that a huge part of donor centricity had to do with silos. It's impossible to be truly donor-centric if each department is going to have exclusive ownership of certain donors. And this is something that I'm very proud of, because people had tried in our 32 years. It had been tried and tried and tried. And finally, it was just given up. We can't help these silos. They're just part and parcel of our organization. Well, again, I went to a conference, this time not in Holland, this time in New York. And while a keynote speaker was speaking, I just had like a flash of lightning strike me. And on the back of sheets that had been used, I wrote a 23-piece new vision of donor-centric fundraising. And I am not saying it was easy, but I came back home and I got together with my fundraisers. I asked them for buy-in. I told them I had gotten buy-in from the financial people in the organization, that everybody would be more understanding if some departments went up and some went down and so forth. But I am convinced that all departments go up when something like that happens, because when the tide rises, all the boats rise. And so I really allowed people to speak their mind. I tried to deal with their objections, to let them know how this would be improved. Because really, if we're to be truly donor-centric, then a donor must have the choice of the way that he wants to give. And most donors, when we lose that departmental ownership that we tend to guard so zealously, when we lose that, we find the donors give by pretty much all channels. And we all know in this industry, or we all should know, that the best donors you can have are those that give by multiple channels. And so that's another large part that we have corrected and are working on correcting. It's a process. It's not an overnight thing. And it has really helped out where being more donor-centric is concerned.
That is fascinating. And I think that you just said something that's really key there, that it is really a process. But I think that it's when your focus is really on your donors that you know that you're going in the right direction. Tell me a little bit more about So during your presentation and what you said just now, 27 asks during the course of the year?
It's 27 appeals, which actually 4 newsletters, but our newsletters are also appeals. I mean, we do very well with our newsletters. Again, very donor-centric. As a matter of fact, one newsletter, which I actually sent to Tom, and he used it as an example in his new book, which is wonderful, by the way, is basically all about you. That was the title of the newsletter. And it was all about the donor and what they meant to the port, to the organization, to everyone. And it was, for that year, the best performing newsletter. It performed over $1 million, which, you know, newsletters have parts that are fulfillment and so forth. So it's not as strong as a you know, an appeal might be and as focused, but it did over $1 million, $1.3 million to be precise.
Oh, wow. From one newsletter.
From one newsletter.
Wow. Wow. And that's the newsletter that's in Tom's book?
That, yes. He refers to it, and he actually put a picture of the cover in his book.
Oh, I'll have to, you know, I've got the book, and I'm embarrassed to say that I skimmed it. I was kind of kicking myself.
We have so much to read that it's hard sometimes to know where the priority is.
We do. But I have to tell you that when I first read Tom's book, I think it's How to Write Fundraising Materials That Raise More Money. Uh-huh. I literally could not write anything without that book by my side, even if I didn't open it. It was... It's a fabulous
like emotional
book.
Psychological support.
Psychological support, exactly. Well, I don't know if you know my work at all, but I actually work very much with small nonprofit organizations. Oftentimes, the executive director is the sole person doing the fundraising, or you've got one development director, no marketing departments, no staff. So what would be your best advice for a small nonprofit in terms of understanding the donor centricity?
Well, speak to your donors and love them. It's impossible to build relationships that are really, truly fruitful if there is no love involved. We have to really, these people are people who are giving of their fortune and their treasure and their time to be able to help people that they don't know and may never see. So just for that reason alone, we should love them. Also, that like everyone else, they have their problems. Some are lonely, some are facing illness. Many of our donors are facing the perils of old age. They're 85, 90 years old. We have actually a very small select file of people over 100 years old in our donor file here. So you have to love them. You have to meet them where they're at. You have to really enjoy talking to them, to learn their pets' names and to ask for them, to see what's happening with their children and grandchildren. Because from love springs just about everything else. You know, in our sector, everyone knows that you don't give to an organization, you give to a person. And you have to be that person for them. No matter what size you are, I think you have to be that person. Don't be afraid to use volunteers. We happen to be fortunate. We are a large 32-year-old organization, so we can afford a lot of things that I understand that smaller organizations can't. But there is nothing more disarming, for example, of getting a call, I am a volunteer for such and such organization. Right away, the listener thinks, oh my goodness, how nice of this person. You know they're not going to ask them difficult questions because they're volunteers. They're not really daily people in the organization. And it's wonderful because they feel this organization is not taking their money to give it to somebody else. They are actually using volunteer helpers to help do this. I know of organizations that use their staff, and one day every 3 months or 6 months or 9 months, they stop everything, and every member of staff calls their donors. Now, if you have a donor base like ours, you have to be selective and say, okay, we're going to call donors over and above this level. You know, start with the lowest hanging fruit, you know, and then you go down as you have time and so forth and so on. For example, I write to every donor that gives a gift of $5,000 and over. I try to call them, but I'm not always successful in doing a call. But when we started our major gifts department, I traveled with the major gifts people to introduce them to all the donors that I had relationships with. And so basically, you know, if you have that situation where you really care enough for your donors, I had to select a certain level to be able to do the job well. Now, in smaller organizations, the advantage you may have is that you don't have that huge size of donor base, and therefore you can have a few more personal things. Have the president of the organization write a little personal note on the side of the letter of some of the donors. You know, that's the sort of thing that makes people feel special, and we all like to feel special. Oh. No matter where you land on the Myers-Briggs, we all like to feel special. That is a universal truth of mankind.
That was so, so beautifully said. So beautifully said. And I agree with you that actually I think in a lot of instances, smaller organizations can kind of have the edge because you've got a smaller donor base.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also make sure that I write my donors things that they don't normally get from the appeals and the newsletters to make them feel like they're part of the inner circle. I also, once a month, I have phone calls. I ask each major gifts person once a month. Each major gifts person will invite 12 of their donors to join me in a conference call. And that we call it coffee break with the executive director. And basically, I am thanking them. I am letting them know what their donations have done up to this point in the year. So basically how many houses have been built, how many wells have been dug, how many water projects have been made, how much education containers of educational materials have been sent, and so forth. And I also allow them to speak, and it's amazing that I am there trying to thank them, and you find that they want to thank you for being the facilitators of that work. But you always have to let them understand that that work is their work, that they are the missionaries. In the inquiry, emotional inquiry study that we did, Pam, we found that the highest peak, they had what they call a pyramid of good. And the summit of that pyramid was actually missionary work. The second layer was actually helping the missionaries. It's important to make them feel that at least in spirit, they are there when a child's life is saved, when an environment is saved, when a river is saved, when animals are being saved from cruelty, that they are there in spirit. Because if they feel that missionary work is the most, the highest, most elevated point of that pyramid of good, then we need to do something to let them feel that although they don't leave their home, that they are indeed missionaries in spirit. So that's the sort of thing that you constantly have to be thinking, what makes them feel good? Because they deserve to feel good. Now, the act of giving in itself, we are so beautifully psychologically brain engineered that the brain releases all kind of endorphins and all kind of chemicals that gives us this wonderful high when we do good, when we give. And they have done studies showing that the times in your life when you were most selfish are the times in your life when you were the most unhappy. And the times in your life when you were the most generous, those were the happiest times of your life. So really and truly, our gift to the donors is that, is to make them feel good about the good that they are doing. So I think we have to think of it 24/7. How can I make this donor feel good?
It is. It is something that you have to think about 24/7. How long have you been doing this call with your major donors?
We started last year, towards the end and around October of last year, and it has been so successful. I mean, I told a gentleman that he, was really living the gospel by doing what he was doing, and he started to cry. He says, that's why I love Food for the Poor so much. Now, what do you think happened to the other 11? They all got choked up, and they all realized, yeah, I love Food for the Poor too, and it's nice for them to feel that way, you know, because needless to say, we are, you know, hoping that they will reciprocate the love that we have for them. And it's an amazing thing when you get 12 donors together who are great donors, who are very generous donors, and it also gives you a very huge advantage that if anything ever happens that is a concern to them or a challenge to them or a problem to them in the organization, they have that relationship with you that instead of stopping giving, they will call you and ask or call you and say, can you give me some guidance in this? I am a little troubled by this problem. How can you answer to it? And of course, we are the perfect people to answer to it. And usually it's very easily resolved. Sometimes it's just as simple as a glitch in the computers. You know, they got the wrong thank you. And, they got the wrong amount or, you know, whatever it is. And I can resolve that so easily. So they feel, okay, if I ever have a problem, I know this guy. And he's high enough in the organization that he is going to resolve this issue for me. And that's a huge boon because many people, if they don't have that personal relationship, they would never call and complain. They would just stop giving.
Yeah, I think complaints are actually good things.
We actually flag our donors that complain as special donors, not as bad special donors.
Right.
But as good special donors because they cared enough. They cared enough to call.
Exactly. Exactly. I see we've actually, I'm sorry, we've gone over the time that I had told you. And this has just been fascinating. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy, busy day to talk with our readers. I was wondering, I have one last question.
No problem.
Because there's just a lot in the news these days about donor retention. And I'm wondering if you would care to share your retention rate.
Well, it depends on the source of acquisition. In direct mail, we are about 40% retention, mm-hmm. Which is our worst. It's our cash cow. It's our looming giant, but it gives us the worst rate of attrition. Mm-hmm. It has 40% retention. Now, our radio donors, we have 70%. Our print donors, it's over 90%.
Wow.
Now, of course, we don't have the quantity that we have of direct mail donors. But just to give you an example, our print donors that are really a fairly minimal part of our donor file, not even 5% of our donor file, they are responsible for more than 10% of the income of the organization.
Wow.
And
that's
impressive. They translate beautifully to the direct mail. Now, our speakers bureau, we are a Christian organization, so we have speakers who go out to the churches, 85 of them, on weekends to preach on behalf of the poor and to mention food for the poor along with it. And those donors, when I look at our major gifts people, almost all of them come from that. And again, Speakers Bureau now has an 85% rate of retention. So direct mail, of course, is the mass media. But the other departments that have less donors, they tend to give us donors that stay longer, that give a second gift easier. But we're always fighting. You know, I people tell me, well, that's better than, you know, when I tell them we have 40% retention of direct mail, they say, we only have 30%, so that's better than the industry. I said, I don't care. To me, that's still 60% that we're leaving on the table, and I won't be satisfied until that, you know, is reduced. And so we find all different ways to get that second gift, and we're always fighting for that.
I think you'll do it.
I am positive we will. Well, that's sweat and tears, but we will.
Well, thanks again. Thanks so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. We have been listening to Angela Loma, Executive Director of Food for the Poor.
Thank you.